it's very difficult in our time to properly mourn for Tisha B'Av. We're very lucky. So thank God it's difficult. You know, life here is generally very good. We don't feel the pain of the loss of Beit HaMikdash. This is especially compounded by, thank God, they have a state of Israel. So it makes it, doubly difficult. Whether we're sitting on the floor all morning, and it's a real minute. The real minute is to say, at least until midday, which is about 1:30 or so. I don't know, really, outside of I don't really know anybody who does it anymore. I'm sure there are places. The Rav used to say keynotes until 5-6 in the afternoon. It would start in the morning, and he would just go. He would just, it stopped wherever he felt like he had given an explanation. He'd go until 5-6 in the afternoon, and then he would go visit the grave of his wife. That was his minhag on Tisha B'Av. The Rav really started doing the public keynotes, I believe, in 1968. I mentioned in the past, Rav Soloveitchik lost his mother, his brother, and his wife in a 3-month period in 1967. And those who knew him before and knew him afterwards, that like, changed his entire life. The way he gave the shiur changed, everything about him changed in terms of the fire and brimstone that he used to have. He relaxed a lot more. That it was recommended to him as one of the ways to cheer him up that he would teach more Torah. When you teach Torah, you're very happy. That's the reason you can't learn Torah at Tisha B'Av. So he started, he started his sort of all-day keynote. And he would just go in Maimonides and go all day and go visit the aquarium of his wife. But it's extremely difficult. And it's a logical question. Why do we still have to say Kino with the establishment of the state of Israel? It's interesting. The Rav does point out that according to many of the Rishonim, even during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, they observed Tisha B'Av. We know the Navi Zechariah tells us that all the fast days are going to be turned into days of joy. And the assumption is, in the Gemara, in Rosh Hashanah, basically says that in the time of when things are going well, you don't have to fast. And the truth of the matter is, our fast now, when we fast on Shiva Saratamus, is only a minhag. It's not even a rabbinic law. It's a minhag to fast because there isn't really overt persecution of the Jews. We have our own state. So there's a minhag to fast. The question is, what about Tisha B'Av? So the Rav claims that even, based on many others, that even during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, we still mourned for Tisha B'Av, because on Tisha B'Av we're really mourning for much more than the Beit HaMikdash. And as the keynote will express, the keynote may be a little less so, but if you look in the Gemara and the themes of Tisha B'Av, we're really mourning for the problems of the Jewish people. What we'd like to call in modern parlance, the root causes of Tisha B'Av. The Gemara says, the inability of the Jewish people. The social sins. That is observed in the keynote, and especially the Haftorah we read last week. Basically, the corruption of the leaders, the corruption of the people, the hypocrisy. It is well known, but you have to repeat it over and over again because it's a lot harder. Our prophets, our sages, very rarely criticize the Jewish people for our ritual sins. They did on occasion, but they didn't really talk about our level of Shabbos or Kashrus or Taurus and Mishpacha. The things that we today say what makes a person an observant Jew. Our prophets had a different version of what made a person an observant Jew. They fed the poor, they took care of the orphan. That's what seemed to be a religious Jew. They were honest, that we read that Torah on Shabbos. God doesn't want our sacrifices. He wants us to be justice and righteousness. From Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, is well known. When he was asked what's the most important role of a rabbi, he said it's to take care of the poor, the orphan, the underclass. The great Rav Chaim, who revolutionized the way we study Gemara, he actually changed the entire system of the way they learn in all the yeshivas is based on Rav Chaim. And yet he felt that the Gemara is a much secondary role for a Rav. The Rav's role is not to sit and learn and to pass the Shaylos. The Rav's role is to make sure there is our our justice system is above board, and to take care of the underclass. It's also known that in Brisk, when the Rambam was the Rav, so they would often, you know, if somebody, let's say, a single girl would have a baby. So these things would happen. They would leave the child on Rafine's door, and Rafine would take care of it. Whenever they were crossed, people would go to Rafine. It was known for the social aspect. So if we look at it from that point of view, why we mourn, I think, becomes more clear. Because unfortunately, those issues, the social problems that we have, and the hypocrisy, and it's built into human nature. It's very hard. We have to work very hard to get rid of it. So that's really what a lot of the mourning has to be about. Of course, the keynote do focus on the Beit HaMikdash, and they focus really from two aspects. How painful it was, and the horrible things that went on, we'll get to, how mothers ate their children, and the destruction, and the horrific, horrific things that we have from the Holocaust. It's one part of the keynote. And then another part of the keynote is to talk about the beauty that once was in Yerushalayim, how beautiful it was. I just returned from a couple of weeks in Central Europe, and I spoke to a few people privately, but it was really an unbelievably moving trip, beyond moving. And I found it very inspiring. And interesting enough, I didn't find it at all. I didn't have any feelings of, oh, how terrible, and all, because how great it was once in Europe. Somehow I didn't have that feeling. We weren't in Poland. We didn't go to any of the death camps. This was more, we were in Budapest, Prague. I felt much more inspired. And to go to some of the shuls, but just a comment on one thing is we talk about what the Beit HaMikdash was, and how beautiful it was, and we can't appreciate. We don't understand. I can just tell you, when I was leaving, when we were in Prague, and I knew I was coming back to Toronto the next day, I said publicly, actually, it's going to be extremely difficult to come and daven in shuls in Toronto. I don't mean this in a negative way, but the beauty of the shuls in Europe are beyond description. The care, just the stunning beauty, and you know, 40 feet, you know, ceilings, the architecture, every little thing, the way they, the meticulousness with which they build the shul, the love and the joy, and it's so different from what we have here. And I actually, you know, it hit me, like, maybe I'm wrong, but the shuls that I saw were so inspiring, and if you multiply that, if that's the way it was during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and the beauty, and we sort of lose sight of that. We don't necessarily, you know, focus on the external beauty of things. But that was also important, the gold and the silver. And we talk about it in the keynote, that the importance of physical beauty, our buildings, our destructions, our shuls. And but on the other hand, I guess on a sad note, which it hit me while I was, you know, going to prepare for Tisha B'Av, we say that one of the, you know, in the afternoon, everybody knows the morning becomes less. We can sit on regular chairs, sort of the mood, it brightens up. And we can ask God to comfort us. Nachem is only said at midday. We don't say it in the morning. We're, it's like in the morning, it's before the funeral. You cannot give any words of comfort. At midday time, it's like after the funeral. The process of healing begins. So, and the question is that it really should be the opposite, because we all know that the Beit HaMikdash began to be burnt in the afternoon. That's why we observe some of the laws of the 9 days until the afternoon of the next day, of the 10th of Tishrei, because the burning was really most on the 10th of Av, not so much on the 9th of Av. They burned it in the afternoon of the 9th of Av. But as the Rav explained, when the Beit HaMikdash was actually burnt, there was a feeling of relief, because God was taking out most of his angers on sticks and stones and on buildings. And even though there was a lot of death, the Jewish people as a people survived. It wasn't so clear we survived. I don't know that people at the time knew that they survived. Who knew they survived? So the that's why we say in Tehillim means more or less up. A song to Asaph that talks on the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and the Gemara says right away, wait, wait, why does this song say taking that? But it's a song because God has taken out his anger on buildings, and he didn't take his anger out as much on the people. And that allows us a little bit of comfort. I guess on the other side of the equation, then, when I come back, I think that there are beautiful shuls still left in Europe. A lot were destroyed, but there are a lot of beautiful shuls. But there are very few people. There's very little of a community. And you come here, and our community is thriving, and we built an amazing community, not only here in Toronto, across North America, across the world, in Israel, of course. So, in a sense, to see the beautiful buildings, perhaps there should be a sad element, because all that's left are beautiful buildings. The people aren't left, and the people is what counts. That's really one of the key themes on Tisha B'Av. It's the people we're focused on. As I was saying earlier, our social sins. We're not focused as much on the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash was just a symbol that the people have reached the proper level that we could have a Beit HaMikdash. That's why Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he was given the opportunity to the Romans offered him anything he wanted, he did not ask for the Beit HaMikdash. He asked to get a community in Yavne, because the Beit HaMikdash, to have a beautiful building without the people being ready for it, is really a meaningless building. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai understood he had to build up the people, and he went to Yavne. That's, I think, perhaps the overarching message for us on Tisha B'Av. We have to work on the people, don't worry about the buildings as much. That's just by way of introduction. I encourage anybody, if you have any questions or comments or criticisms, please, I don't necessarily just have to talk, maybe people can throw in comments if they'd like or ask any questions. Okay, what we'll do is we'll say 9 or 10 of the keynotes. I'm not sure what books everybody has. Who has the book of the Rav, the new Koran? So I'll announce pages in a couple places. You'll find them, you'll announce pages. And give a little bit of an introduction, go through them, we'll see the keynote, and we'll see. Hopefully it'll be meaningful. And okay, we're going to start with Eka Atza, Afeka. That is
the number of the keynote.
I'm sorry?
The number.
Yeah, number 7, Zion. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Yeah, so maybe it's the third Tina, I think. The second Tina, we say in the morning. I'll probably say it at some point. Okay. It's page 17 in the Ziegel line, which is a lot harder to follow, and page 217 in the Koran Mitzvah, sorry. So, see, Rav Elazar HaKalir, I'm sure people remember that is the author of many of our kinos and our slichot too. He's a great poet of Paitan, and of course we don't know when he lived. There's a big debate when Rav Elazar HaKalir. We know very little about him. According to Tosfot, he was a Tana, lived in the time of Tanaim, but most people assume that's not correct. We don't know for sure. Some put him in the 6th century, the 7th century, and the 10th century, and one of the keynote he talked about, apparently, he talks about not having a Beit HaMikdash for 900 years, but the Rav says, so it appears he lived in the 10th century. I think part of the whole, I think this is actually indicative of Tisha B'Av. It's not really important when he lived. In other words, the fact that we don't even know when the major person of our Knut lived is sort of what mourning is all about. The Rav has often talked about how mourning, we are confused, our time sensitivity is lost. And that's why within the Kina, sometime within one Kina, we talk about first, on the first Beit HaMikdash, the second Beit HaMikdash, other tribes, they're all combined into one. In that sense, it's sort of ahistorical. Tisha B'Av is a focus on Jewish tragedy. And when they happen and where they happen is sort of less important for us. It's the message that we have to learn, the way to repent from all that's happened. But the timeline when it happened, as the Rav said, is very unimportant. That's why Rav Soloveitchik is well known, was very much opposed to having Yom HaShoah. because as the keynote will say later, the keynote on the in 1096, the destruction of the community peace in Germany, the Crusades. So it says that we shouldn't add any other days of mourning. Tisha B'Av is the national day of mourning of the Jewish people, and the Rebbe was very much opposed. His father, his uncle was very much opposed when Rav Herzog wanted to introduce Yom HaShoah. The Rav's uncle, who was living in Israel, was very much opposed. And really, the force of his personality really has didn't make it. Yom HaShoah has never really made it. I mean, it may maybe in the general type of a community, but it doesn't have a ritual attached to it. Rav Herzog wanted to make it a fast day. You know, which it's maybe even worse than what happened on Tisha B'Av. And that didn't happen. And the Rav felt that we only mourn on Tisha B'Av. There's one day when the events happen that are important. I can even tell by the reactions in the room, I think most people find this hard. Most people feel, I think we're living in the generation after the Holocaust. But that was the notion. On the other hand, if you think about it, we made a fast day for every tragedy or another day of mourning, so the Khomeini massacre, to the Crusades, with every other day in the calendar would have a problem. The pogrom in 1348 in Budapest that I didn't know about until I got there. The whole community was, you know, wiped out in the 14th century. And see the shul all destroyed. We roll everything into Tisha B'Av. The Rav was also opposed to even saying a kina on Tisha B'Av. He felt that we today don't have the right to compose. Rav in this way was very small C conservative. He was opposed to any innovations in the shul. Rav felt that we today don't have the power to compose a kina. What I find, you know, kind of interesting and fascinating in the Rav Matzer that they put out, I think just like last year, sort of right before Tisha B'Av, in the Korah Matzer that some of you have, there are three kinos on the Holocaust. Almost nobody has accepted this view of the Rav, including his own students. The top students of the Rav, and all their shuls, they all say the keynote. Rabbi Lichtenstein, his son-in-law, he disagreed with the Rav on the changing on nothing. The Rav felt we have no right to change nothing, because nothing that we say talks about a desolate city, a destroyed city, without children, empty. You read it, it just isn't true. Baruch Hashem, it isn't true. But the Rav felt we don't have the right to change it, and without the Beit Hamikdash, with the fund we have, it's metaphysically it's true. It's not in that sense. And that's how the Rav felt. But Rav Gorin, he changed it, and he was the chief rabbi, and Rav Lichtenstein apparently agreed that you shouldn't say that. The problem is most of our Sidurim print the old version. I think Archgold, of course, but I think all the Sidurim print the old versions. But one should be aware just of the issue. But because Tisha B'Av is sort of ahistorical. It's all our tragedies. And until there is peace and the people are united, the full force of Tisha B'Av is reserved. That's how the Rav felt. So therefore you have been sort of identified with this is the problem that we don't even know when Rav Elazar HaKalir lived. It's not important in a sense when he lived. But his poetry was extremely difficult to understand. If you read it, and it was also very, very creative. He invented words. The Rav also said that without Rav Elazar HaKalir, I don't know, he said we couldn't have, you know, modern day Hebrew wouldn't exist without Rav Elazar HaKalir, because he was the one who sort of just, you know, a language has to grow and develop. You know, our English is not the English of the Middle Ages. Shakespearean English is very different. So the Hebrew has to evolve. Because Rav Elazar HaKalir was the one who gave it the impetus. Even Ezra has a critique on Rav Elazar HaKalir. What right does he have to turn nouns into verbs and just sort of use the languages he wants? But he is our main paikan on Tisha B'Av and on Rosh Hashanah. So eight thoughts of a pesach. Let's go through this. So here you have the aleph bet. Many of the keynotes go aleph bet. Many of them are takeoffs on words of eight itself. But here you have eight atzav a pesach. You have there are five alephs. If you look, atzav a pesach a bet adonim emunecha, and then there are six bets: brief, tarim, Beirarta, Bishunecha, Bitin. And then there are five gimels. Be'arta, Be'arecha, Galot, Be'in, Gulecha, and six salads. And it's five, six alphabetical. The five represent the five books of the Torah, and the six books of the Mishnah. And basically, what Rabbi Lezer HaKalir is comparing how God, Eicha, that's the theme of Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, we have to write that God, how could he do this? What's right? Does God have to do this? God, how could you allow these terrible things to happen? And he didn't remember the special relationship or the promises he made to the Jewish people. You're not keeping, in a sense, your half of the bargain. So how could you, in your anger, to lose and always be out of the mean is going to be our enemy. Sort of the yad gaydin. The next one, those who are haughty. The yad hamonim, those who make fun of us. Each one, how could you allow these adonim? And of course, adonim is a reference to Edom, which our sages interpret as Rome. Of course, those who destroy the second day of the Christ. The yad adonim emunecha. Emunecha is us. Those who have faith in God, the Jewish people. The Lo Zachart of Brisbane Haftarim, you didn't remember the covenant you made with Abraham, Asher Be'arta, that you chose, the Difunecha, to the one who passed all the tests. Bifina, Abraham was the one, our sages say he passed 10 tests. So how, God, could you allow the descendants of Abraham to be thrown into the hands of Rome? The next line, Eta Ka'arta, Be'arecha, how could you, like a lion roars, the ka'ara of a lion, the ka'ara of God, your anger, the galot, to exile us, yachayim, and those who are haughty, the arrogant ones, the ulecha, those who you redeemed, how, God, could you allow the Jewish people to be thrown into the hands of the lion? The lo zacharta, you didn't remember, the lidat yibud derech, the way how fast you took us in the desert, we read on Shabbos, Chadas Aryam, make a raid. It was an 11-day journey from Egypt to Israel that we did in 3 days. If you look at it, we did it. Unfortunately, it turned into a 4-year journey, but it was really meant as a 3-day journey. A shared dilakta, that God, we skipped. The digalecha, those who are our flags, the Degel Machaneh Yehuda, so how could you have that the contrast between the love of God and what happened. And this is how it goes through the whole series, the whole Aleph. The next one, Eka Hakta Behegonecha Lazofia Hololim, a Holel is a scoffer. Those who make fun, the first pair in Tehillim talks about the negativity towards those who make fun of everything. The Lo Zacharta V'Ud Beset. The U, the Beit Vad, the place where we come together, a moed, a holiday, is the same root, that we come close to God, sort of a meeting place. On Yontif, we have to go to the Beit Hamikdash, the meeting place of God. The Lo Zacharta, the U, Vetek, like Vetek, the special time, we came together, Asher B'yad HaLevi Udecha, and we cry out. It says, let's see, and in the letter cut, Eicha kivanta b'kasecha, how could you, in your anger, lechalos b'yad koshlim karmecha, how could you wipe, destroy those in the vineyard, a reference to the Jewish people, v'lo zacharta lo lishnoach l'olam asher limad et olukecha, and you didn't remember not to forsake the Jewish people. And this is the cry of the Kina, and it ends, Tanil Mishpoch Leif Kamayim, our heart cries out, with tears flow like water, Amel Yom Den Nishtinu Kamayim, on this day can hear the rhyme, on this day we were taken captive twice, a reference to the destruction of both Beit HaMikdash, Zachri V'yoti B'shalva Yoshev Yishmayim, I remember when we used to sit in peace and comfort in Jerusalem, Raganti Bata Adeh Atu Yishmayim, and I cry out now when I want to soar up to the heaven. And that's sort of the lead into the next. That's the Adet Atur Hashemayim, which we won't do. But Rabbi Lezer HaKalir in this Kina does not answer any, he does not give an answer. He leaves it as sort of a lament, if you want to say it's a complaint, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for allowing all this to happen. Okay, we'll say the Kina. I don't think all my explanations will be quite as long, but okay. Hey, Pastor, what's that? I'm going to be the other one. What's the first thing? So each one of the Aleph Beis, Rav Elazar HaKalir took from the first chapter in Eicha. Eicha is really the first of our kinos. Eicha is really a big kino. And there are 24 stanzas, I believe, two more at the end, because the kina talks on the 24 mishmarot, the 24 like watches, the cycles of how the Beit HaMikdash runs. We know that you don't need so many people to run the Beit HaMikdash. Beit HaMikdash was not such a big area. The whole area of Beit HaMikdash was 500 amot by 500 amot. Amot maximum 2 feet. It's probably less. So the standard size of the whole Har HaBayim, not the Beit HaMikdash part, everywhere, was 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet. It's not tiny, but it's not huge. But that's the place where all the Jewish people are coming. What's a fifth of a mile? Less than a fifth of a mile. 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet. That was what Herod expanded it later. But the Beit HaMikdash was relatively small. And the Beit HaMikdash itself, the Kohanim actually, there were two parts really, two main parts. The part where anybody could enter, anybody who was, whether it's the Ezra's Nashim, then where the woman stood at the origin of having a Mechitza in Shul, and then you had the place where the people were bringing a Korban, the men could come in, and then that was, about 20 almost wide, not so big, 40 feet, and then the Kohanim, where only the Kohanim could go, was 11 almost wide, very narrow space, and there were two mizbechot, the mizbeach haktorah, where only the Kohen could go, that they put the Torah there, and it's used a lot on Yom Kippur, but it really was used like very little. The Korbanot did not go there, most of the Korbanot did not go there on a daily basis, just the Torah. And the regular Mizbeach, where all the Korbanot went, that was sort of where not Kohanim could enter. And then the Kodesh HaKodashim was sort of, each step you're going like close. And the Kodesh HaKodashim, where the Kohen Gadol, only the Kohen Gadol could go only once a year. So you don't need, how many Korbanot were brought every day? Two. On behalf of the Jewish people, a Korban Tamid in the morning, a Korban Tamid in the evening, and then individual people brought the Korbanot. Most individual people who brought Korbanot would probably bring them at dunk time. They're not going to schlep. You don't have to bring, if you make a promise to bring the Korban, you have three holidays to bring it. So if it's before Pesach, you say in February you're going to bring the Korban. You have until October to bring it down. You have to bring it right away. Well, Tucker, you can't delay more than three holidays. There's actually a debate, because that's in Pesach, isn't relevant now. So most people aren't going to run to the Beit HaMikdash every time they want to bring korban. If they're coming anyway before Pesach or Shavuos or Sukkot, they bring. So that was the busy time of the year. But most of the year, it wasn't so much going on necessarily in the Beit HaMikdash. And the korbanot in general was not the main function of the Beit HaMikdash. No, we think that way. We say on Yom Kippur, bring us to the Beit HaMikdash. Because this is a house of prayer for all nations. The function of the Beit HaMikdash is more prayer, not the korbanot. It was a big loss and down. It was a gathering place of the Jewish people. But the korbanot was just one function, one of the many functions of the Beit HaMikdash. So how many kohanim had to run the Beit HaMikdash? 50? Maybe? I'm sure less to run the Beit HaMikdash. So how many kohanim are there in the Jewish people? Thousands of kohanim. So they divided the kohanim into 24 mishmarot. It's not, I don't believe, it's not a magic number. It could have been any number. That was a convention. They divided the kohanim into 24 mishmarot. They divided the levim. There was a parallel. We say on the Shalosh Regalim. What do you say in the Musaf? In Basienu? Israel and the Behem. I don't remember them, sir. But we talk about the Kohanim, the Levim, and the Israel. Each Jew, each regular Israel, was assigned to a Mishmar. So every person in Klal Israel was on one of 24 of our rotations. That's called the Mamadot. And what happened is when you're weak, when you were on call once in 24 weeks, every 6 months, so the Kohanim and the Levim would go work in the Beit HaMikdash, the Levim were in the choir, and they would be the guards of the Beit HaMikdash, and the Yisraelim would go in their towns and daven. And the mission employees, they would also fast. They would read Bereshit, they would read about the creation of the world. Il malei mamazot, if not for the mamazot, ukot shemayim v'aretz lo samti, God would not have created the world. That's what the rabbi said. So this is like, we would read Bereshit, it was a very serious time. Those Jews would fast, and that they don't have to fast all day on Thursday, getting ready for Shabbos, all the halakhot. But every person was assigned one of 24 of the mishmarot. They were on a rotation, Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim. And so here the Kinah, Rav Elazar HaKalir, talks about the loss of the 24 in Mishmarot that we no longer have. And he basically throws in all the names. Historians, people point out, without this Kinah, we wouldn't know who a lot of the Mishmarot were, where they come from. You'll see some like Tzfat, Lechem, Alevo, these are names of places and or families. So, again, I mentioned Echa Yeshva Kavatzel and HaSharon. How was it? Look how beautiful it was, the rose of Israel, that the Daman Ron, Mithin Nosei Aron. But now, by Edom, it's all silent. The Ron, our Rinah, our song is silent, Mithin Nosei Aron, from those who carry the ark. The Levim were the ones who carry the ark. That's all quiet now. Benahu Minish Morotam, and they were. Had a wander, not minish moratam from our watches, Kohanim b'nei Aaron, the Kohanim of Aaron, minisar habay, minisarvein mis-maron. That's a reference to Yeho Yarib, that's what the commentary says, the first of the mishmarot. Then they were the ones on watch when the temple, I think, on Tisha B'Av, and misarvei, that means they went against. What's the modern Hebrew? Disarray is to disobey. Thank you very much. Yes, to disobey. And so here you have already the beginning, the elements, the sins of the Jewish people. Bachot, as will be picked up. Bachot, mikumshet tasvarim. We cry for the loss of the five books of the Torah. And Arak kohen ben aviv yom ha'kippur. So this is. Mention every year, but you have to mention every year. For one of the main sins in the keynote, Kinarai Kohen and Aviv Yom HaKippur. It's an amazing thing. The Jewish people killed a prophet, Zefari ben Yehodaya, on Yom Kippur. Kinarai, he was a Kohen, and he was a Navi. Being a Navi was a very unpopular job. It's like being a rabbi, sort of.
I say that only half jokingly, because our rabbis aren't on stature in a Navi. The Navi was the one who would tell the people what they're doing wrong. That's the job of a Navi. The job of a Navi is not to predict the future. That's not true at all. The word Navi actually means a spokesperson. That this first time appears in Chumash by Aaron. When Moshe said, I don't want to go to Paro by myself, so God said, Aaron Afika Yemediyaka. Aaron will be the person who speaks on your behalf. So the Navi is the spokesperson of God, who says, you better improve your social justice, your thing there before, or else this might happen. And you don't need to be a prophet. People know our society. If you don't clear up the fiscal mess, the stock market's going to crash. It already happened. Okay, whatever. But you don't have to be a prophet to realize that if politicians can't agree how to run a country, the country will turn into a mess. And so if you don't, that's on an economic front, which also, but on a social front even more. So that was, but nobody likes to hear that. When the rabbi gets up, he gives like, listen, he's talking to the other guy, people walk out of shul, nobody's interested. We don't like to see here people telling us we're doing things wrong. And our rabbis understood it, and the rabbi said that if you think it's not going to be effective, don't say it. The rabbis say the same way it's a mitzvah to say something that will be heard, it's a mitzvah to keep quiet, it won't be heard. That's why rabbis often don't speak up, because it lowers your status. If you say things and everybody ignores you, you have to pick your battle. But being a Navi, you weren't allowed to be quiet. That's the difference. A rabbi can be quiet if he wants. A prophet can't. There's a prohibition in the Torah. It comes with a death penalty at the hands of heaven. A prophet who doesn't say the prophecy. If God tells him something, Jonah tried to run away. Look what happened, right? So prophets were very unpopular, as we know, for good reason. So the Jewish people got upset and they killed him. What are they going to do to knock him off? In the Beit HaMikdash, on Yom Kippur. Unbelievable. And the Jewishers say when the Babylonians when the Nebuchadnezzar entered the Beit HaMikdash, apparently they say his blood was basically boiling, seething through. You could see the blood. And the Babylonians said, "What is this?" And they told them, so they started killing people to sort of make up for the blood until the blood stopped. So they went and they were killing thousands and thousands of Jews were killed because of this blood. That's how our rabbis thought. Until the Nebuchadnezzar said, if the blood doesn't stop, I'm going to wipe out the entire Jewish people. The final solution of the Jewish problem. And that's when the blood quieted down. And this sin comes up over and over again. The audacity to kill the Kohen and the Navi in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur. It's really quite something. So that's Bakot Tiftev, we cry, K'nera Kohen, the Navi, the Yom HaSikurim, Ba'odamon Yishvatu, Prafi, Tisikurim. And on that blood, on an account of the blood of Zechariah, Nishvatu were slaughtered, Prafim, the little children, the flowers, Tisikurim, like birds. We killed them up. The Nadu Tisikurim, Konei Tisikurim. This is a reference to town of Tisikurim. The Tisikurim, the play on words. Galkami Artsak Halam Kushaka, the bride who was all adorned in her jewelry, Kushata, Ba'avon Masrot Ushmita. So here's interesting. Here we flip to a totally different scene. The non-keeping of Shemitah and the Masrot. So the Masrot means our lack of concern of the poor. We were not careful in our tithing. Ushmitah, we didn't let the land rest. The Torah in the Chukotai, when it gives all the curses, says, Asir se'aretz et shaftoteha. God will exile us, and then the land will rest from its Sabbath. And from this, the rabbis learned that one of the reasons of the exile was because we didn't keep the Shemitah. So, and that's why we were in the land. We needed the 70 years to make up for the 70 years of the Shemitah, 400 and whatever, 90 years, that we need to make up for the Shemitah we did not keep. That Now, probably what the reference is that that Shemitah is always viewed in our ways a test of faith. That how can you not plan for your what is? That's irrational to observe the laws of Shemitah. So Shemitah is a tremendous test of faith in the land of Israel. And the whole purpose of the land of Israel is to develop our faith in God. That's why there are no natural resources in Israel. Now they made a major gas pump, thank God. But really, Israel, we don't have water. The whole purpose is we have to look up to God for our to develop our faith. That's why we have a land that's not an easy land to work with. So the Shemitah most likely represents the lack of faith. It has nothing to do. I'm not talking about nowadays the heads of Akiris. Don't misunderstand that. I personally think it's very important to use the heads of Akiris because the options are a lot worse. We shouldn't buy from the Arabs, we should buy from our own people. But the concept that we can have trust that at some point to observe the Shemitah, so that's what the sin we're talking about, our galut happened because we didn't keep the Masrot and the Shemitah, before we were judged in four ways. In Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah says, there are four punishments for not observing the Shemitah. Death or I don't remember them now, but if you have the Pirkei Avot, if you remember, it says Bavon Masrot, and it lists the four things that come. That's what Rabbi Lezer HaKalir is referring to. Darkei Hechal, Damamu, the pathways are silent. Kinifrat Katlo, when our wall was broken, Bahameil, Kinifrat Katilo, the Meil, that's the coat, the Kohen Gadol wore. Kinifrat Katilo, it was cut, the teal of the the fringes of the coat were cut. So, etc. This is going on. Just for the next one. Hayum alibi belof me lechem. Those who fought on bread. Kibit lo halof haros ra'eit lechem. Why? In other words, the famine. Kibit lo, because we nullify halof haros ra'eit lechem. For us to spread out, we didn't give the poor bread. So because we didn't get the poor bread, we were punished with hunger. We were hungry and thirsty. From bread and water. We couldn't bring the Shtei HaLechem. The Shtei HaLechem was the korban brought on Shavuot. That's probably why he mentions it, not the other korbanot. Also the wine with the lechem, whole notion of the lechem, the bread. But the Shtei HaLechem, we do it on the day we receive the Torah. We bake lechem. And the whole thing is from Beit Lechem, the place where we don't have bread, and it says, well, we didn't get bread for the poor, so the Kohanim who lived in Beit Lechem were destroyed. This is kind of reminiscent. So one of the ironies in the way how the Tanakh is written in such a powerful but often indirect way on the story of root, which we read on Shavuos when we have to bring the Shtei HaLechem. So where are Eli Melech from? Eli Melech is from Beit Lechem. It's so ironic. It's not a coincidence. In other words, what's Eli Melech saying? I have to leave the country because there's not enough food, right? And he was rich. He didn't want to share his food. That's how Rabbi understood. He would have to give away half his wealth. He didn't want to do that. So he ran away. So the root, in other words, in a subtle way, we're saying, what do you mean there's no food? You live in Beit Lechem. You live in a place of food. I think that's a subtle hint to what's going on. The same thing here. So this is how the kina goes. The kina ends. I'll skip to 7. You see, if now you understand why the rabbi is until 5 o'clock, and he only did 3 or 4 of the kina. Because every single line here has layers and layers of depth and meaning. But if you sit to the letter tzadik, if you can see it, tzadiku Hashem kitigu marat. So now Rabbi Lezer HaKalir is shifting. In the first kina, he's blaming God. God, how can you do this? And we go back and forth. God, you weren't right. You broke your promises. So to speak. How can you allow this to happen? You promised X, Y, and Z. And now, Sadiku, now you live. On the other hand, God, you are justified in what you did. We're sinners. We brought it upon ourselves. And both themes go back and forth. Again, this, we have to be very careful not to impute, you know, impute this to what goes on in modern times without, you know, prophets. It's the Rav was you know, often said, but the only one that borders on blasphemy to say that the Holocaust happened because of sin X, Y, and Z. How does anybody know that? And you can't say that. I think you are allowed to say, because great tragedies happen, what can we do to improve ourselves? But that's not the same thing as saying the tragedy happened because of sin. It's one thing when there are prophets, and Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu are saying the word of God, that we can give a reason for something. But that's very different from what goes on now. I think that's just important to keep in mind. But the idea, and this is true even today, the idea is when tragedy happens, we have to look inwards. That's always our Jewish response. In Mars, you have to look. What are we doing wrong? What can we improve? Forever, it's happened. So, God is righteous. He pu mari, because we have gone against His word. But our Yisod Babu Barat, that's what we say in the Shir HaKamal, and Omar Babel, was destroyed all Yisod to the bottom of the foundation. Usmur Uzi Bezimra, and instead of it's Muraz, a replacement for Uzib Zimra for song, Kinim Aleha. Then we are saying our lamentations, Ubekatseha Aris, Nizrat Mizrat. And we were thrown out to the land of the world. Nizrat is, of course, you know, in Nazareth. That was where one of the Mishmorot was. And then the last line, Tavo Tamriyah, Tashriyah, Kubidesha, Tadim Tafriyah. This is a little bit of hope. There will come a time where we will have all the spices, the reyach, the smell, the Tashri, Tashriyah, Tazriyah, Kubidesha, Tadim Tafriyah. And our bones will grow and flourish. The reyach is Tadim Tafriyah. And the sweet, savory smell will be like old Mishulchanat Tarit, and from your table we will be the guests on the table of God. We'll eat the korbanot again. Shulecha Manarev. So the Kina ends on a positive note. Okay. Okay, the next Kina 17, so we're skipping the whole bunch, but 6 or 17 off. 375 is the Koran, and in the Zigohain it is
the bottom of 29, the last line of 29. We call comments, especially for now, although it's basically trees. Again, Rabbi Lezer HaKalir, again, an alphabetical acrostic. Here he's talking about the terrible tragedies and what became of the Jewish people. The lows we sunk through because of the terrible hunger and the stare we were at that people ate their own children. If the woman, it's actually based on a pasuk in Eicha, we didn't make this up, we read it last night, that the woman will eat their own fruit, their own children, olalim are the children, people seem, like I think from the word of a tefa, a hand breath, in very small children. And of course, this cannot, perhaps more than some of the others, is very reminiscent of the Holocaust, right? Of the terrible hunger and things that went on. Before we went on the trip, the trip started in Budapest, but there aren't any flights right from here to Budapest. But everybody had a flight somewhere to meet. So we decided to go a couple days early. We were in Warsaw. So obviously we went to Warsaw. We had the worst. Again, what's striking, I don't know how many people have been to Poland. I imagine some of the younger people have. They go on, March of the Living, etc. But I didn't get any of these places. And one of the striking things was how, if you lived in Warsaw and you didn't know anything, you wouldn't know anything. You wouldn't know anything happened. There are monuments throughout the whole city, hundreds of monuments about all kinds of things, including the Warsaw Ghetto. There are memorials in there, but there are hundreds of memorials, there are all kinds of things. Warsaw was apparently totally destroyed in the war. There was one or two buildings left in half the city. It was absolutely wiped out, and there was a debate, apparently, is what we found out when we were there, whether to rebuild the city or just to leave it they rebuilt the city, trying to recapture some of the things. What's interesting, most of all the European cities we were in, the non-Jewish government, the non-Jewish authorities are very interested in preserving Jewish history. They turn it into museums. They give a lot of, they pay for the upkeep of the shuls a lot of the time. It's interesting, they are on the tourist map, so on the one hand, there is an interest, I think, and we know that a lot of these countries are now much more pro-Israel than the countries in Western Europe. Interesting, the Eastern Bloc, quote unquote, the former Eastern Bloc is much more pro-Israel than the Western world, the liberal countries, so that is very interesting to see. But there was only one shul in Warsaw that was left standing after the war, and there is a small community, a very small community. They're actually building a museum. The government's building a huge museum for 1,000 years of Jewish history in Poland. It's not yet finished, but we saw the building is getting there. That's interesting. I don't know. One can debate and argue whether we should be building up the communities in these old places. All I can say is that in the Middle Ages and beyond, for the modern period, it was very common. Jews were expelled from a country and they came back. The Komeniski massacres happened in Poland in 1640. That was the Holocaust this time. Wiped out a third of the Jews in Poland. A few years later, they're back. Maybe they didn't have places to go. Now that we have a state of Israel, it's maybe the whole thing is there. But it's just interesting to see. You can see they take you to the sewer where people escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto. They also show you that the people Mila 18, people who they basically killed themselves. So we have with the Romans too, and this is a very common approach, where Jews would actually kill themselves rather than be taken captive. The Crusades have it a lot. It's in the Kinoch. In Masada, of course, we had it. In the Holocaust, we had it. And there is sort of a debate within Jewish law, is this an appropriate activity? Many rabbis think this is appropriate, that it's rather than be taken captives and the torture and the terrible things, and also the fear of what people may do, especially in the Middle Ages, they may convert, they may not have the power to withstand, and they may be converted to Christianity. So there is a strong tradition
commit suicide. What is tragic, and we have this in Jewish history, and that's what our driver is telling us in Warsaw, is after a bunch of people committed suicide, they found an escape route. And a few people escaped them. But that sort of compounds the tragedy. We had one of the keynotes, I don't know if it's in the keynote, but we have a historical record in 1096. We know this was actually very common. The Jews actually killed themselves. They killed the children. They killed themselves. They didn't want the children to be brought up as Christians. And they knew they'd all be taken captive. And in one town, they all killed themselves. I mean, the Crusaders, for some reason, they didn't go into the town. And these terrible things happen. That's unfortunate. In a sense, the keynote here is saying what people did. I can tell you the one line is they have the Rav has quotes it. It's quoted in the muster here. It is the one on the horses. Okay, I don't see it here, but I know it's there somewhere, where they basically would take people, they put them on a horse, alive, and go off, and bouncing up and down. So the Rav says that his first cousin was, it's in the
top of page 30.
I'm sorry?
Top of page
30. Top of page 30, yeah. Where does it say? Pas Rosh Hashanah, right there. Thank you very much. But the Sharnam is to see for him. They take their hair and they tie it to the riding horses. That's what they would do. So the Rav describes how his first cousin, the week of Sheva Brachos, right after the Sheva Brachos was captured, and they put him and his wife on two cars, put it together, and then they just sped off both ways. And that. That was, and he said, everything we find in the keynote we found in the Holocaust. That's part of the Rav saying that it's not that we don't memorialize the Holocaust. He just felt it should be done on Tisha B'Av. And so this talks about the eating, the hunger, how people hid their children so they could eat them. And it talks about the killing of the Kohanim and the letter Mem. So this is a great tragedy. You'll become less from me'elef me'ah. You have 1,000 Jews, we're down to 100. We me'ah sarah from 100 to 10, ad la'achat, until 1. 1 in 1,000 who survived. It's interesting, we were in Prague in Theresa's death. That was the one camp. It wasn't exactly it wasn't a death camp. It wasn't even exactly a concentration camp. But 150,000 Jews were killed. From their ship to other places, deported. So you go there's a whole map of all the concentration camps and the death camps. So he said, which people don't often realize, that Auschwitz was really there were camps that were a lot worse than Auschwitz. The reason we know more about Auschwitz is more people survived Auschwitz than anywhere else. There were camps where literally they had one or two or no survivors, where 500,000 people were killed and nobody survived. The reason we all know about Auschwitz is because Auschwitz had the greatest number of people who survived. So the greater tragedy, in a sense, is that their communities wiped out. We don't even know about them. And we were in a lot of cemeteries. That's part of Jewish history. And I found the cemeteries inspiring. I mean, we're seeing great friends, the Yehuda, the Maral, and so forth. Great, people live wonderful lives. But they have in the cemetery in Budapest, outside of Budapest, they have for the Holocaust, it's really done so movingly and so beautiful. The communities that they don't know who was killed, what was what's left. So they have for each community a little headstone, like a foot tall, or pretty tall, and rows of them. Like, 80 communities in Hungary were wiped out. Here they think 1,800 Jews, 2,000 Jews, and they list everything they want. And it's not like in a square. It's really very, very powerful and moving. And there are no, we don't remember. The shul in Vienna, where 70,000 people currently in Vienna, it's unbelievable. It's a gorgeous shul. Then off on the side, they have sort of in books, like you turn the page, kind of big, and they list every single name of every person in Vienna who they know killed. you know, thousands of names. You go into the shul in Boston, I think, I forget where one of the shuls also, they list all the names, but there's no remembrance of people. Whole families were wiped out. Our memories are based on people who lived. But here you have, as the Kina says, 1 in 1,000, half place 1 in 1,000. So that's it. They're lost to Jewish history. They're lost in our way. They live on in other ways, but it's hard to know. It's very, very sad. But anyway, so that's the theme of the Kina, the other faith. We have to cry out to God for all the horrible things that happen. אם תוכל לנשים קריאה, אני רואה איזו שהיא נשים רחמניות, the woman who were full of mercy, ילדים המדודים, תפקים תכים, children who they counted half right now. Paragraph after he finishes the alphabetical acrostic, he turns the shift onto the Jewish people. Baruch HaKodesh Mulam Marim, Hoya Poshkinim Marim, Mashi Kram Odim. In other words, God answers, Baruch HaKodesh Mulam cries out, Mashi Kram Odim. What happened to them? They say, our suffering, you say, that I share Suba. What we did, Lom Odim. We don't let people what we knew. In profile Nashim Kuryam, actually the fact that the mothers had to eat their own children, we cry out. The Indian Arab Midash Shem Kohen and Ami Lomashim again they said, but the fact that we killed a Kohen and a prophet in the Bain Amitash and Yom Kippur, that we don't mention. But so this is again Rabbi Lezer HaKalir making us to focus inward. It's something we don't really like to hear, but to focus the Kina inward. Okay, we'll do the next Kina. It's also a back and forth between what was and what is. In other words, all the promises that God said to us, and then what happened to us. Like, Vatamar, and HTTVMAP, and then, of course, it's an alphabetical acrostic. You said you'll be good for us, Niflinu Aniv Amap, and our nation will be a distinguished nation. The Lama Eliyahu, why did the enemy, those who worship idols, Hilulusha Map, that they have desecrated your name? This, of course, is another major theme that we cry out not only for what happens like to the Jewish people, but for the glory of God. That when the nations of the world, when the Jewish people are suffering, this is a desecration of God's name. This was, of course, Catholic theology is very much classic Catholic theology. The little I know is based on this notion, is that Jew has to suffer for what we in their mind did to their God, and therefore the suffering of Jewish people is an indication that God has left the Jewish people. And that's why the creation of the State of Israel is such a Kiddush Hashem. The suffering of the Jewish people is also a desperation of God. That's why the Vatican mentioned couldn't recognize the State of Israel, because it goes against their theology. As much as the relations are a lot better, much better, thank God, there's still a difficulty in the Vatican recognizing Israeli supremacy on Jerusalem, let's say, because it strikes to the heart of the replacement of Christianity of Judaism. And the Navi Yechezkel, of course, you know, talks about when we'll come back to Israel, not because we are worthy,
but because God will have had enough of his name being all desecrated. I'm sure people are not thinking of the Rav. I think I may have mentioned this in the past. Rav, so when he used to travel with, the Rav arrived in the States in 1931. He arrived in the States. We also mentioned he used to daven when he was a kid, a teenager, when he was in school. He used to daven, he should never end up in America. Because they knew in America, there's no Torah there, the religiosity, you know, Europe was full. The Rav was daven, and he says, thank God, God didn't hear his prayers. God said, no, thank God. He left out. That's why we often don't know what we even have to daven for. We daven for the wrong things all the time. So the Rav arrives in America in 1931, and he comes to Boston, to Bahim. He settles in Boston, sets up a yeshiva there, whatever, not important now. In 1941, his father, from Moshe Soloveitchik, who had come to America earlier, who was the Rosh Yeshiva at FYU, at the university, he dies, and after much debate, the Rav is only 38 years old, and he's not really known so well, especially in America. So the Rav, after much debate, is offered the job in New York. I mentioned before, they offered him a one-year contract on trial. They weren't sure he was any good. And there was a lot of opposition to hiring him, but they hired him for a year, and the rest, as they say, is history. But the Rav never left, Boston, as I'm sure most people know. He felt he had a community in Boston, and he never left. And so he traveled to New York every week. He would leave New York, he would leave Boston on Tuesday, originally Tuesdays and Wednesdays, he would give a 4-hour shiur and spend, one night in New York, 2 days in New York. And then when the Rav had a cancer operation in the early 60s, his doctors told him he had to slow down and he can't give a 4-hour shiur. So the Rav switched to three hours, gave a shiur on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for years. He traveled for 45 years. He traveled every week from Boston to New York. So he originally would go on the train. So the Rav counts before, in the early years, Christian missionaries and non-Jews would taunt him with, God, in the Holocaust, and after the Six-Day War, a Jew could walk with, pride. We could hold our head up high. And that's really one of the major things, that is to repair God's name, so to speak. And Yechezkel HaNavi talked about that. That's why God will bring us back. And I mentioned, the Rav said, why is our generation worthy to have the state of Israel? We're not more worthy than the Kli Yakar, the Novi Huder, the Nilmagan, or Rafaim. We're not more worthy than them. But our generation needed it more. After the Holocaust, we could not have lived without the state of Israel. The fragile nature and all the slew of the modern world, the way it totally changed the way of Jewish life in so many forms, the future of the Jewish people was at stake. So that's how the Rav felt. We don't know, of course, but the Rav felt. So therefore, our generation needed a state. Other generations could live without a state. So our generation can. Which country is that? Anyway, so here, he said, why did the B'nai Glial, they desecrated your name? The Lo Shafach Shalein Tameh, and you didn't pour upon them, say, on Pesach, Shvach, to pour out the anger, Shvach, Alein Tameh, why did you pour the anger? Atag, Gidalta Viromamta, that's taken from the Haftorah this week. Bamin Gidalta Viromamti, and the Haftorah said in a negative sense. God raised us and we turned against them. Behem Pashubi. But here, you lifted the Zabbanim Lahanit to suck, to come close to Hakar Sparta, Kashir Yisal Mena Teyomet, just like the bird takes care of the child, a nursing mother takes care of the child. The Lama Totanim, and why were we thrown to the wolves, to the lions? He took out honey from the rock, that's referenced in the desert.
The tosi nozli misela flowed. It flowed out our liquid. See, here it says tain, but we assume it's only water. Right, that flowing from the rock, the lama shoftei nishmatu b'tei sela, b'lein nifatsu al selam. Why were we judged on the rock and the very track? Olaleam nafatsu al sela. Our children's heads were smashed on the rocks. Atah taza nafta batimas kol goy, lachata gomi kerakoy. God, you rejected the other nations. You took our nation from Mikerakoy, from all the worlds. The lama kasha la alarzi goy maru lefuvin lechem goy. So how could it be that a nation will come to our land kasha alarzi goy maru lefuvin, and thus make the Jewish people stop being a nation? That's always been the cry of the anti-Semites to get rid of the Jewish nation. And this is, of course, this is the theme through and through. What should be the promise of God and What did it? The last two verses, Batashma Lohim Keinu Kerpa, God, hear that we are a embarrassment, we are a laughing stock of the nations. The Sukatka Ba'esh Nisrafa, and your, a tabernacle. We know what a sukkah is, but the imagery of a sukkah is, it's a reference to the Beit HaMikdash, but also a sukkah is a protective, like, notion. A sukkah, cross the lane of sukkah shlomecha. God to fit the canopy, put our sukkah to spread upon us and protect us. So our sukkah was burned in fire. So lama tivala nachala chupa, tatmir chupa valenu. We pray to you that which is growth, tatmir chula, that the redemption will grow. And then he ends, Batasadika Kolaba, God is righteous, Lakashem Hasaka, and that's Kabishiba. Very interesting. God, to you is righteousness, and we will righteous Bichibat in love. This is very hard. The notion that we accept your judgment with love. That's what the Rabbi Elazar Kalir is saying. The Lama Nahiyu Velanu Hadiba, because of Banu Bechoba. All this came, Bechoba, all this came, this was a payment for what we did. The notion again, has seen the acceptance of the judgment of God. Okay. Okay, we'll go to 21, Arzei Halbanon, 32 in the Zigohain, and 415 in the Korin. Also a famous Tina, that's Arzei Halbanon, the Zigohain, Tehran, the Asara Harugei Malchut, on the 10 martyrs whom the Romans, killed. We of course read this, twice a year on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av, although it's very different. The descriptions are different. The whole goal of reading it on Yom Kippur or on Tisha B'Av is different. Tisha B'Av we read it as mourning, and Yom Kippur we read it as sort of an atonement. There is a notion that death of the righteous atones for the people. The Christians, of course, picked up on that.
in great detail, but the true matter exists in our tradition that when a righteous person dies, it atones for the sins of the people. I don't think it's mentioned automatically. It means it's supposed to inspire us to be true. But there is this notion that the mita is makaper. So that's really the theme on Yom Kippur. On Tisha B'Av, the theme of the Esther Malkuth is one of tragedy. Of course, you count aren't 10 people listed here. This is, of course, what we would call a historical fiction, I guess, and I don't know if that's the right word exactly, because of course there was no story of Asara Harugimachut. It's not the way described more in Kippur than here, that the Romans, you know, gathered 10 rabbis because the brothers had sold Yosef, and the Torah says that if you kidnap someone, you sell them, you get a death penalty. So where is the death penalty for the selling of Yosef? That was the Roman their argument. So they gathered 10 rabbis and they killed them. That's the way we the story is told by Yom Kippur. Of course, it's not really accurate at all because the rabbis died. I mean, it's a poetic license. It says the rabbis who were killed died over a 100-year period. And I'm sure more than, you know, 10 rabbis were killed. And but what the Paitan does is he's highlighting 10 of the greatest sages who were killed by the Romans and the tragedy and despair that followed. So are they all known that the Reha Torah, the cedars in Lebanon, the strength, as the Reha Torah, the defenders of Torah, Balet Risin, that a shrisak is a war instrument of a protective, you know, cover for Mishnah, the Mara, Iborekho, Amaleha, the Torah. People in strength, Amaleha, the Torah, they were toiling in Torah in purity. Damam Nishpach, the Nishtak, were out there. Blood was spilled. Hinam Kidushay, Harukure, Makutasara. Here are the 10 holy martyrs who were killed. Balela, Anibokia. And I cry for thee, Beinanikran. The tears are streaming through. Then they go through the Nafal de Goral of Rabban Shimon. So the rabbis explained that there was a debate or an argument who should be killed first. Rabbi Yishmael, who was a Kohen, and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. That's the famous, you know Rabbi Yishmael, where the Shoshim Reim Midrash that the Rabbi Midrash had. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel was the Messiah, I think that. The lottery was that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel was killed first, and Rav Shmuel took his head and he sort of he cradled it. He says, "There are Ron Shalach Bakashali Kodah Ben Hadira." The child of Aaron, the descendant of Aaron, asked that he could cry on his friend. Natal Rosh, he took his head, and Natno al Arkavatavi put it on his knees. Minarah Hatzarah, the light that gave off the golden light. Of course, the menorah written lit in the Beit HaMikdash. Stam Einav al Einav upiv al piv, he put his eyes on his eyes, his mouth on his mouth. Ba'avakimra with a deep love. Anav Amar, he cried out, Tehami Kaber Torah, the mouth that was strong in Torah, he omnit nasa alav mitam mishuna batamura. On him was declared a horrific, harsh death. Sivah mahashit as rosho v'tar hasira. So the Romans then commanded to peel off the face of Rabbi Yishmael. The Medrash said, because he was very beautiful. He was very handsome. So the daughter pleaded to keep him alive, and the Romans refused. But they said, "Okay, we'll peel off his face." I don't know exactly how this works. They peel off his face so you can see his beauty, so to speak. That's what is the reference. But they took a razor, very horrific. And then we describe the death of Rabbi Akiva. Everybody knows that's the famous story. They were basically torturing Rabbi Akiva, and he found this as an opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of Asher Hashem Elokecha b'chol l'tzavata b'chol nafshecha b'chol modecha. And it goes through one by one. Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, who was the one who gave slicha, that's the famous story, the last one. The Romans knew that if they could break the smicha line, our traditional line of who the rabbi is, how we would, you know, we put your hands like Moshe did to Yoshua. Without rabbis with smicha, you cannot have a Sanhedrin. Cannot do much of you cannot like legislate new laws and to a large extent and cannot invoke a lot of the laws of the Torah without a Sanhedrin. So the Romans attacked the institution of smicha and they gave a death penalty if you gave smicha. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba was appointed to the sage as the last person to give smicha, and they succeeded. The Romans basically, we don't have smicha today. We don't have the real smicha. We don't have the Sanhedrin. We don't have the ability. The weather can recreate that ability. That's a separate question. But in practice, we don't have it. Rev, goes through one by one. Rav Hananya ben Treshen, who was the father of Bruria, the wife of Rav Meir, killed for teaching Torah, etc. And so the last paragraph, Kahena ben Kahena hosifu b'nei Avlel anot b'gara, like this and that, the enemy, they kept doing it with in meanness. B'skilas reifah herakah, behemeth, they killed us in all the forms of death penalty, neil kal v'shara. Who can estimate, who can tolerate this? Those karakimena yachlu are yachshev v'ra. And more than this, we were thrown out in the lion's day. In other words, if you can find us on the street, people would just eat us alive, animals would eat us. But they, tufa, hashraf, yichma, harfu, arneha, v'ra. The people who used to wave the korbanot of the Beit HaMikdash are now eaten up by the lions. Yitav Hashem, alo yosif, ovi yisra, God, enough already. Don't bring any more pain to the Jewish people. So, okay. Are they helping on the great Torah? Okay, next Hina, Al-Baloch Yirmiyahu of Sidney Avot, Hina 26, so we're skipping, I think, 4 Hinot, page the bottom of 39 in the Zigohai, 469 in the Koran. Azalaki Rio can bring up a book. So this is based on a measure that Yirmiyahu Hanavi, who is of course the Navi, wrote Eicha according to our tradition, and the Navi Bibi who prophesied many of the terrible things that would befall the Jewish people. So Yirmiyahu goes to the he goes to pray, so to speak, on the graves of our forefathers. The dear bones. He says to them, why are you lying? In other words, you should be in heaven. He tells our, what are you lying in your graves for? Go out and tell God to help the Jewish people. The Nechem Galu, your children have been exiled. Ubatekem Karibot, and their homes are destroyed. Vayesu Tavot, where is the merit of the fathers? The notion that we are the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Sha'u kulam mikinim al chesron banim. We have to lament on the loss of our children. So v'vuv kol v'kot ha'chunim. Vayeh ha'pachat v'sachar k'lehem brit v'shneim. He says, in other words, cry out, go to God and say, where is the promise you made to remember the covenant? So the kinah goes through that each one of the avot that came with a plea to God to listen to the Jewish people, and God basically steps and sees the end. God says, no, your plea isn't going to work. So first you have Avram Avinu comes first. Zaka'a Avamon. Avram is the Avamon Goyim. Bavaram. So Avraham cries out on behalf of the Jewish people. The Finam Shnei Avram, Finam Nusayti Eser Bekinot Avram. Did I for nothing go through the 10 tests? Did I do all my work? I didn't do it for myself. I did it to found a great nation. Behem, Him Chaziti Shivram, and now I see how they are broken. Vayeh Haftachat Alti Ravram. Where God told Abram, don't worry. What happened to that promise? Look, this is what happened to our children. So God answered Abraham. Your nation mistakenly followed false gods. They worship idols. They went to dig broken wells. Of course, this is a reference. Abraham digged wells. You know, Abraham and Yitzhak built all the wells they have then, which is, of course, a symbol of their what they were doing in the world to make a better world, to create a society. Right? When the Torah is describing the building of wells, building up the city, that's the description, how they were making their contribution. So Abraham is digging one well, but their children are digging broken wells. You have to know what you are digging for. You're digging for, you know, gold or who knows what. And God says, how can I stand by where they have nullified the Aseret HaDibrot? So Yitzchak comes up. He says, "Lashav b'tevach u'chach." What, you think I went to the Akedah? I offered myself. I sacrificed myself up. The Hain's already. We know that Yitzchak was not a 2-year-old child. He talked to Abraham. He asked Abraham where we're going. So he was very much aware of what was going on. He agreed. So what happened to that? Where is the promise that I will make the covenant with Isaac? Marubi Yirmiyahu Kimu Har Hamoriah. So God says, well, they rebelled against Yirmiyahu. They didn't listen to the prophets. The Kimu Har Hamoriah, and they impurified the temple mount. Then the next, Yaakov wakes up. Zach Yalev Ditelah Maot Kitanim Zolet. The one whose tears were crying. I presume this is a reference to his crying over Yosef for all the years. In other words, why are we being sold? Why are we, all the things that happened, Yaakov Avinu is crying out to God. Interesting, there's no answer from God. In other words, God answers in the Kina to Avram and to Yitzchak. Yaakov is already the founder of Christ. So I don't know why, it's why, but it could be that Avram and Yitzchak, Abraham had one of the 8 children, who went, you know, on the Derek, and we would take seven of them and take children went off the Derek. We had eight children out of them. We only know about, you know, one really. And, you know, Yitzhak had two children, and one went off the Derek, 50%. Not so great. People nowadays, half their children go off the Derek, they wouldn't be so happy. Only Yaakov Avinu, even though he had a lot of problems with his kids, and they weren't perfect, but all 12 of them remained. That's really the story of the Chumash. It was why Sefer like Bereishit ends where it does, is because the book of Bereishit is the story of who's part of Klal Yisrael. And in every generation, we're not really sure who's part of it, because there are battles. That's the whole fight. I mentioned before, that's why Yosef, that's the way the Rav explains the fight between like Yosef and his brothers, is, well, in every generation previously, only one child was chosen to carry on the mantle. So there was a fight. You know, the brothers thought that Yosef wanted it only for himself. He was going to be the only brother, the only son. So they were, so what happened is, by Yaakov, we have a switch where all of his children become part of Bnei Yisrael. So once they're all Bnei Yisrael, that's now we can move on to our national history in Sefer Shmot. So there's no answer to Yaakov. Then, you know, but God doesn't agree. Then comes, you know, Moshe, Kasro, and Naaman, the faithful, you know, shepherd. In other words, Moshe carried the Jewish people. Again, he nursed him. Again, there's no answer. And of course, the answer, the famous answer, so Leah and Rachel, that's from, you know, Yirmiyahu, we read that the Torah on Rosh Hashanah, that Rachel's crying for her children. So the four wives of Yaakov Avinu come out. Shuz meaning, so God answers, go back, the pure ones, to your rest. Go back to your grave, so to speak. Malei amalei kol mishalot. I will fulfill all your requests. Shulafti Babela Lamantem. I sent you into exile for your sake. Very interesting idea that the exile is for us to learn our lessons, to grow, to become a better people. If you're not punished, sins, you can never learn. So we were sent to Babel to work on our Beirut. We've had now a very long exile, 2,000 years, and when we can learn. I don't know how good a job we're doing exactly all the time, but that's the goal of the exile. Is to learn to be better. I will return you back to your land, which we have seen in the beginning in our generation. So that's, of course, we know that it's Rachem of Akal Banem, and God's response to Rachel. I just want to add a thought I was thinking that the Medrash, you know, famous, it's not so much in the Kina, it's Rachel and Leah, and Bila and Zilpah that God is answering. But you know that the Medrash says that it was in the mirror of Rachel because when Lavan gave Leah, when he tricked Yaakov, so Rachel and Yaakov, the famous Medrash, were onto this. So they devised a code system. And then at the last minute, Rachel didn't want her sister to be embarrassed. So she told the code to Leah. And in that act of tremendous self-sacrifice, to give an attitude of mother, that's it. She never had, her relationship with Yaakov was always troubled. It was a tortured relationship. She didn't have, she couldn't have children. She complained in the Torah. They're arguing with each other. They yell at each other, as it says in the Torah. Why are you screaming at me? Yaakov says to Rachel, I can't give you children. And of course, it's really Leah. It's Leah who's buried with Yaakov. It's Leah's children who are the Kohanim, and the Malchut comes out of Leah, not out of Rachel. So this act of self-sacrifice was not just one act. It was the whole future of Jewish history was changed by this act of Rachel giving up her love her sister, and it was in that merit, that act of self-sacrifice, that God inspired. So I was always bothered by the question, maybe, that that, you know, it's all very nice. The Rosh Hashanah is extremely wonderful. I don't want to cast any stuff, but what about Yaakov? Is that fair to Yaakov? Why is it fair with Rosh Hashanah? It's okay. She, unless you want to say Yaakov agreed. It could be. There's no indication. In other words, it seems like Rachel didn't know. So I thought perhaps, based on an idea that this intimacy has by Yaakov himself and Esau, you know, when Yaakov trips his father, you see, in a sense, you could argue Yaakov had to pay. In other words, Yaakov is being punished for him tricking his father. So he got tricked. So in a sense, maybe that's the real idea, that Yaakov had to pay for what he did. But it's interesting. So when Esav comes back to Yitzhak and he asks for a bracha, and Yitzhak realizes what happened, so it says Esav cried a bitter cry. What is Yitzhak? Zakam Tegolav Umara. I don't know what, something like that, right? So the measure says, don't think that God didn't hear that cry. That cry was repaid in Shusha when Haman did his decree. So Mordechai goes out of the city by Yitzhak Zakai Gedolav Umara. In other words, events that we did, I mean, Yaakov in a sense was being, you know, punished for the hurt he brought onto Esav for what he did, and the threat of what happened in Haman was as a result of that. That's not how the measures, you know, paints it. So the Nitziv asks, why are we punishing Yaakov for what he did to Esav? What about what he did to Yitzhak? The measure is blaming for what he did for Esau. But he did to Yitzchak, didn't he love? That's a lot worse. Esau is a no good thing. Who cares? He deserves it. He had sold the birthright anyway. So it was his to begin with. Yitzchak, it's not fair to Yitzchak. So he said that sometimes in life, you know, you have to, when you there are certain things that have to be done, and sometimes people have to suffer in it. In other words, you know, you couldn't compare with Leah. And the only way not to compare with Leah is to hurt Yaakov a little bit. Right? And the only way to get the before away from Jacob, you had to do it, was okay. It wasn't great, but you didn't have any choice. But he says, that's provided you're doing it because you have this grand vision in front of you. That Yaakov understood he needed the brachot. Leah understood she couldn't embarrass, Rachel understood she couldn't embarrass her sister. It was done with a pure motivation. But he said, when Yaakov was, he felt terrible that Yitzchak was going to have to suffer. He felt bad about it, but he didn't have a choice. That was the only way to get the prophet. So he wasn't punished for that, because he did, it hurt his doing. But when he heard Esau, that he got a little joy out of. That he got, no, Esau, he deserved. He wasn't doing it, Esau, for the right reason exactly. He felt that Esau, you know, it's like you want to get back at something. If you want it, that's the point he makes. It's a very powerful point. In life, of course, in leaders, all people have to make a decision that will have negative effects on people. That's what our political leaders have to do. But if they're doing it because they really want to do it for what's right, they don't have to pay the price. But if they do it out of a personal vendetta, out of personal motives, through their brother-in-law's, you know, business will help, or what they'll give the tax break here or there, you know, the company they like. If they're doing it not for what's the good of the nation, but they're doing it on a personal thing, so that's a lot worse. So that's why Yaakov was punished for what he did to Esau, that there was a little bit of joy to get back at Esau, but not the way he did to Yitzchak. So it's good his name in here. That what Rachel did, she had to do. She had to do. And Yaakov had to suffer. There's sometimes it's in shape. It's choice. In life, that's the tragedy of life, that often when we do great good, not everybody will benefit from the great good. But that's the way it is. I don't think that's just that. But the beautiful act of self-sacrifice is what God heard and why God agreed to redeem the Jewish people. As a lot of you are
Don't lose the day. Okay, we're going to go to Kina 38.
We're going to do a big jump. Page 52 in the Zegel line, page 577 in the Koran.
Sion
Akeret Sea. The last 8 or 9, you know, Kina, there are officially 45 Kina, I think, on the show. 4 or 5 at night, and they're 5 at night, and 4 in sort of the official standard, you know, in the keynote. Not including what we say on the Holocaust. The last, 10 or so are the ones on Sion. In other words, we not to mourn the destruction of the temple or the suffering of the people or what happened, but to say the beauty of Yerushalayim. We begin the one before Tzion Halot Kishali, the famous one by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that we cry out for Zion. But each one talks about the beauty that once was, that is no longer. It's sort of as Rav points out, we have two notions in our tradition on remembering the Beit HaMikdash. We have, Zecher LeMikdash and Zecher to the Churban. In other words, we do a lot of things to remember the Beit HaMikdash. So things like the 3 weeks and the 9 days and not eating meat and putting ashes on your head when you get married and breaking the glass at the wedding and other things you don't really observe anymore that you're supposed to leave the part of your house unfinished at the entrance way, or you're supposed to not use all your fancy cutlery, etc. A lot that are sort of less observed. So those are all to remember the Beit HaMikdash. It's not really to remember the Beit HaMikdash, it's to remember the loss of the Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So we have, as the Sefer, for the Churban, we do a lot of things. But then we have a lot of things done to in a positive sense. We take the Lula for 7 days. That's happy. That's that happy thing to remember. Because in the Beit HaMikdash, and in the Beit HaMikdash only, the Lula was taken all 7 days. Everywhere else was taken only for 1 day. So we have a lot of takanot we do, a lot of things we do to remember the glory of the Beit HaMikdash. The Hoshanas in a way is also like that. We do to remember the glory of the Beit HaMikdash. So the last keynote, the last like section of the keynote is to talk about the beauty of Israel, what it really is. Not so much focus, I mean, it says, yeah, we don't have it anymore. We don't have all of it anymore. But it's focusing on, what I was talking about at the beginning, the beautiful shoes you have in Europe. And if these are, I'm sure the Beit HaMikdash, with the gold, the silver, etc., was much more, in a sense. And those shoes, there is, I do mention, because again, it's sort of somehow we've lost that notion. The halakha, the shuls, and you see this in Europe all the time, the Maharal shul, the Altman shul, you have to go down. That's the shul I talk about, where the Kliyakar, the Nova Universe, you have the night shift, the Tosaf. There's no shul like that shul in Jewish history, with the great, no other shul in Jewish history had the rabbinic, leaders, one after another, like they had in the Altman shul in Prague. I don't know how many people have been in the shul, so it's a little shul, and 150 people maybe can, and it's not, it doesn't have that beauty that some of the other shuls in Europe has. It was built in the 14th century. It's in the same place. It's the oldest, functioning, shul in the world. That is still in operation, for 700 years straight. So you have to go down. Why do you have to go down? Because you weren't allowed to build, I think that's the reason, and I know for sure in other places, you couldn't build a shul taller than a church. In other words, the halakh is, when you look at the Shulchan Aruch, the shul has to be the tallest building in the city. A guy's not supposed to build a home, a four-story home that's taller than a shul. The shul has to be a more beautiful building than one's home. And they followed this halakha in Europe. But of course, the church also had a rule that no buildings were allowed to be taller than the church. So a lot of the shuls, in order to make them really tall and beautiful, they would go down. So when it went up, it wasn't higher than the church. So inside it was a very, very tall building, but it wasn't quite as tall from the outside. But there was a tremendous sense, and I don't know, I think the Jews in Europe had a lot less money than we have. We have needed for Jewish education, I understand, but that's a whole other issue. But there really is something that the beauty with which it will change. And I'll be very honest. I think the conservative and reform movements are much more careful about this than we are in Orthodoxy. In conservative reform schools, they will never dumb it in a house.
Dumb it in a how can you dumb it
in a basement? That's like a terrible thing. And their schools are all beautiful. I mean, they tend to be very nice, aren't they? For whatever reason. But the bottom line is, most conservative and reform synagogues are very nice places. And that's not true about Orthodox, you know, places. It just isn't true. But there are exceptions, of course. And I don't know, that's, I just mentioned it. It's something that I thought about a lot over the years, but being in Europe, it really struck home. How the beauty, and somehow we are meant, because we have a lot of beautiful homes. Lots of people, beautiful homes. But the shuls are nowhere near as beautiful as the ones. I don't want to stop. I'm not here to criticize anybody. I'll get in the trouble. I don't want to do it. It's not for me. I'm not the judge. I'm just saying as sort of observing sort of the fact that, yes.
Just want to point out that in the earlier days of Jewish settlement in North America, there were
I agree. The downtown schools in Toronto, even today, the ones that are no longer, they sold to church, that's absolutely true. The Jews who came here at the turn of the century built like beautiful schools, which some of them you can still see today. And unfortunately, most of them are not churches. And the reason they are churches is because they were beautiful buildings, and the churches were happy today. I mean, okay, Jews moved, they have the money to keep the money, but in other words, why were churches interested in taking over? That is true. I don't know when it happened. You're right. And the early shuls in the States, the Toro Synagogue of Stanford, you look in the Jewish Center in the York 80s, all the, or Young Israel online, all the Manhattan shuls that were built 100 years ago, and they all also have. You know, I commented, if you know how the Jewish Center works, anybody be on 86th Street? So that's, you know, Mordechai Kaplan was the first rabbi, the founder of Reconstructionist, you know, Judaism. Right? And he was not Orthodox when he was the rabbi of the Orthodox, you know, shul in the Jewish Center. But he was English-speaking, and they couldn't get another rabbi, so they begged him to become the rabbi of the shul in 1918. And he told them, I'm not Orthodox. I don't believe in forming a Shemaim. It's okay. So, also, that's an amazing thing. That's not the exact time I'm going with, but still, it's, and he agreed he'll run an Orthodox, in person. He'll be Orthodox in public. And what he does in his private life is his business. But, so he was the one who developed the idea that the shuls should have a brotherhood and a sisterhood and a gym and a so-called. What you do notice in Europe, you walk into the shuls and you walk into the shul. There's no social hall. There's no lobby. You go straight from the street into this beautiful building, like just a few feet from the street. There's no lobby. There's no room for a Rakitish club, and there's no room for the board meeting. It's a shul, the place to come to settle. In America, we came up with the idea of a brotherhood and a sisterhood and a wedding hall and a social thing. Not bad. Maybe it's a very good thing. But so it was Mordechai Kaplan who really came up with that idea. We copied him. That's one of the reasons I think Reconstructionism never actually, it never was a big movement. I think one of the reasons is because Orthodoxy took his ideas. The Bat Mitzvah, it was Mordechai Kaplan. His daughter was the first Bat Mitzvah ever, right? Like what those are in North America. He invented the idea of having like a Bar Mitzvah eventually. Today we all do. If people knew it came from Mordechai Kaplan, maybe they wouldn't do it. I don't know. But so it was his idea. So he developed the shul. So in the Jewish Center in New York, it's like a 10-story building that they got, all kinds of things. So I was thinking when I walked into these buildings in Europe, it's a 50-foot roof. So I walked in there. It's a Jewish Center which has a very nice shul, but it's not quite like in Prague or Budapest. Or Vienna, you walk in. I said, imagine they knocked out the floors. Like what they did in Europe, they couldn't have floors. They just wanted to go straight up. They want that, 50 feet of all built up artwork and everything. So I said, imagine they just like knocked up the middle and it went all the way. What it was built. I said, I don't know, but anyways, it's just we're at the end of the keynote. Only half the people left already. So now we can But it's something that really it struck me a lot, and I thought about it a lot. But I do agree. I think whatever money our community has should go into Jewish education, not into schools now, because of the high cost of our education. But there is something that just kind of was really very powerful in a sense. So here, this is why I got into this, whatever. So because again, to talk on the beauty of Jerusalem, how beautiful it once was, so let's just go through part of the Kina, then we'll just do one on the Holocaust and Yitzhak. So we're almost finished. Siyon Ateret Yitzchak Amonach Shalom Kinar Kumiyet Adonai. Siyon Ateret is Ateret. It's a beautiful. The joy for the Jewish people. Shalom kenahar. It's peaceful like a river. You know, the nice, beautiful, flowing, like peaceful, grand river. The angels are guarding the walls of Jerusalem. Remember, there's heavenly protection. Laila v'yomi yishun, day and night, people are seeking out Jerusalem. Shalom v'machanayim, there should be peace in the camp. Gavim v'nechutim v'chol arba k'safot, even those in the four corners of the earth, the Jews of outside of Israel, v'heim d'orshei shlomet notek v'banayim, they seek out the peace of Israel. Shofnei kfarim, those who are in the graves, they await the day of the redemption, the day of the resurrection of the dead. But Aziz Mechu, and then they will grow. They'll come forward, to sprout forth. Those who are sleeping now in the grave will come forth. We who seeks your peace calls out from the mountain, but another up. Shalom l'tzion mabet tzedek. There should be peace to the house of justice. V'shalom aleichem lech v'chomot yikar v'nachminah. And peace on the beautiful walls, yikar of nachminah, and the jewels. In other words, talking about there was a halakha how you had to build the beauty. Shalom l'eretzi, shalom l'chol agul galad. Peace on the land. And this is going through it, let's see here. Then, Eit Era Yafyach. He talks a little bit in the middle about we cry, we no longer have it, but then by the letter, by Eit Era Yafyach, the time will come when I'll see your beauty. Akram Ashurim Bashir, I will call up the people to sing in song. Eit Atzah Anayit Akram Anayit. But now, when I see what has befallen it, so I have to call out those who lament. Afgar leka'at the kifud yishkinu ba'at. Bo'oili im adon va'arakim le'biknat. This is very interesting. He said, I would prefer the ka'at the kifud. I believe that's an owl and a vulture. Yishkinu ba'at are dwelling in it. Bo'oili im adon va'arakim le'biknat. In other words, it's better it should be empty and desolate that foreign nations shall be ruling in it. And we know, historically, the foreign nations could not conquer Israel. They know it was a desert land. When the Zionists came back in the late in the 1800s, there was really nothing there. Swamps, malaria. No nation could settle the land, which in a sense is a blessing of the people. It's a special land for a special people. Ir HaMelucha, the city of the kingdom. How Jerusalem is not only the religious like center, the Jewish people, for salvation, often pointed out, this is a halakha. Jerusalem is the capital, the political center. This is part of Jerusalem, the political center of the Jewish people, the David Shlomo, which by the way, without getting in, not discussing a political sense, the Rav, the famous comment we talked on Nishba, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, I mentioned earlier, was willing to give up Yerushalayim to get, you know, Yavne. He felt that there was nothing left to save the Yerushalayim. You have to start again in Yavne. The Rav, of course, you know, famously said that he would give up Yerushalayim in order to save one Jewish life. That as beauty, as important as Yerushalayim might be, the Beit HaMikdash, it's not worth the Jewish life. But I mentioned right at the beginning how we are happy in a sense that God took out much of his anger on sticks and stones and not on people. No matter how beautiful the Beit HaMikdash or how important Yerushalayim is, it's less important than a Jewish life. Not many, I think the majority of the religious Zionist world does not necessarily espouse a Kippa. Who am I? But I happen to think he's 100% right. It's not for me to, you know, obviously, Yerushalayim is not worth one Jewish life. You can argue that maybe the only way to save Jews is that Yerushalayim. That's a political military question. But as a theological question, as a religious question, it is our political center, it is a beautiful city, but Jewish life is worth more. The temple for God, the resting place for the sewer for the rock God, we're looking forward for the day when God will come down to accept our covenant. Some, the Shulchan and Menorah, run agreed. So now it goes through what was in the Beit HaMikdash. The table and the menorah and the Aron, the Aron HaBrit, etc. That displays the love of the Jewish people towards Yerushalayim. And then we'll do the last like, paragraph, Echsot, the Echsot, the Nechama. I wait for, I'm jealous, I yearn for the Nechama, the comfort, the Tishmana, the Reign of Aser B'Kol. And we can hear the voice, that we'll be able to hear the voice of God coming back to Jerusalem, which we've heard in our generation. God has knocked on the door of the Jewish people to come back. The time for the exile has ended. So it's a process, but the beginning of the end has begun, we hope. He's already correct, though. They wake up to call your... Our beloved, wake up to God's call. And wake up from the ground to return to the place where God has said that. Now that God has returned to Eretz Yisrael, so we have to follow that. Especially true for those of us who live here, which is, you know, most, but not all of us in this room. That it's also an important message on Tisha B'Av. Now that God has returned to Eretz Yisrael, whatever that means exactly. We don't know what to be, but it's, we have to follow. We have to, at least if we're not living there, to invest in Israel and support Israel, to let it be the religious and political center of the Jewish people. So you want to say,
Okay.
Within one of the keynote on the Holocaust, it's not printed in the keynote, but all the modern day the keynote present a few for Shimon Schwab. The one I think we did last year, the Roosevelt one, which is absolutely beautiful. It very much follows the way the keynotes were done. That's one in England. He was the first one to put up the keynote put in English, sort of a edition. It's not so popular anymore, but that was, I think, the first of the ones. But we'll do the one of the Bum of a Rebbe. It's in the Rav's Masor on 627, the Rav on the Koran Masor. I imagine it's in the Art Scroll. Anybody got the Art Scroll?
Yes.
390 in the Art Scroll. And well, it's actually, quite short, as we mentioned earlier. Even those, whatever one's feelings of, they're having a separate day for Yom HaShoah, for the Holocaust, everybody agrees it's obligated to be included in the keynote. Except, I mentioned the Rav really did not say a special keynote for the Holocaust. He incorporated the Holocaust in what he did, but he was very wary of new prayers and new introductions, but his view has not been accepted. So we'll do here the keynote of the Bava Rebbe. Okay. Zichruna v'konanu kol Yisrael. Remember and cry out of all of Israel. Kochem nishma v'ramah. Your voice should be heard on high, just like by on Racha. Kol v'ramah nishma. Ki hishnida germania et ameinu v'meizam ha-mazamah. That, Germany destroyed our nation in the terrible days of the war. With terrible deaths, with hunger and famine. Don't forget for all generations. Unfortunately, that's already begun. Hasn't taken long. The world has forgotten. Until we merit to see the comfort and the redemption. The akatam of the Yote and Sufim was screaming, their cries and screams in the catacombs, pushed together. Sufim was screaming, closed up in the catacombs. But some of Tebach Yival, like sheep to the slaughter of the Sreifa, the Kishonim could be burned in the crematoria. Their voice will always be heard in front of God. The Rav, we said that the halacha in the Rav might believe that the Jew is killed because he's a Jew. That's dying al-Kiddush Hashem. No matter how sinful the Jew was, the fact that he was killed because he was a Jew sort of atones for his sin. That's famous halacha that if a Jew unfortunately is killed, you bury him in the clothes he's tilted with the blood. You wouldn't do a tahara, you would kill him, and you'd bury the person in the blood stained clothes. If he was killed, then we evoke the mercy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But Rav actually used that imagery, that halacha, to explain why he thought the flag of Israel has a sort of a sanctity to it. He said the flag of Israel is like the clothes of the Jewish people. In other words, whatever it is, they're wearing, there are some people who have been killed because of the flag of Israel, that the flag of Israel becomes like the clothes of the person who's killed, gets a kedusha to it, a sanctity. That was the Rav's often what he would do. He would take, he would always do this, he would take halakhic categories and then sort of apply them to the modern way, but that was a sort of a beautiful idea. So the notion that the voices are heard often in heaven, people who are killed in such a terrible way. The Karam Shema Yisrael Mashun Avshama Benemi. Those who cried out the Shema as they handed over their soul to God. Roshei Yeshivot the Talmideim, the great scholars and the students, Vahamoneim, and the regular people shama. Heavy doom be inuin kashim, they worked hard labor, beharkun be adrama, they were filled with a raised hand, the meyaladim rakim so kime lechamin adama. The cries of the children, the little children are crying from the ground. The kom nikmah kapanashim, avenge the death of the children, the women and the children, both the chayat on the shama. As the enemy cried out, we will not leave anybody alive. This is reminiscent of the keynote, which we didn't do
in 1096, the Meeting of Shemayim, that remember what happened, the Crusaders, they came in, they burned the people, the Torah, the shuls, Shechuba Eish Nitasheel. They put a fire in the temple of God, against all the shuls, Hititube Enenu Sofiyot, Yashlem HaMavir Tateira. That's the pasuk in the Shvatim. That if you light a fire, you have to pay for all the damages. So in other words, they should be held account, held responsible. The enemies should be held responsible for the fire they caused the Jewish people. God should bring in judgment on the nations of the world. The heavens and the earth cry out on the thousands of cities. Arsot Europa Mikilotad, Europe and its communities, Naflame Kamehme Sarah, those who kept our traditions alive, Sadiqim, Sainim, Chazidim, Bekeim, Manat Sarah, the righteous, the old, the pious, those who had a pure faith. The young Galina Miyarsenu, Lokaya Kazek, Kalyon Narada. This is from the day we were exiled from our land, there has not been such a great, terrible destruction. It's interesting. Not surprisingly, in modern times, in other words, he said hasn't been a greater destruction since we left. In the Kinan, the Crusades, he actually says the Crusades is worse or as bad as the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. In other words, here, the Bava Rebbe is sort of saying this is the worst of tragedies since the destruction of the Temple. But you have other Kinan that put things even worse than the destruction of the Temple. Just sort of an interesting idea. Now, of course, the destruction of the temple is not just the destruction of the temple. It's, in a certain sense, all the tragedies are a result because we were exiled, because we were a wandering nation. But using that own country, that's why so many of our disasters could happen. Rachem Asher Retenu, have mercy on those who are left. Habeik Nav Nishamayim, look from the heavens. Lamachanot HaKadoshim, to the holy camps. Ti Esther Kiyosim Yitzrayim, 10 times the people left the Egypt. You know, they're, you know, you have 600,000 males, and that's the number we use who left Egypt. There's really more, but in the Torah we describe it to 600,000 people who left Egypt, 10 times as many first were killed in the Holocaust. Komeve, Kachenu, Benachmenu, Pichwain, let God give us even more to double our comfort. Romemenu, lift us up, Bavienu, Litzion, Vishalayim, and bring us back to Zion and Jerusalem. That, you know, it's also hard until when you see when they're in Tereshisat a couple of weeks ago. Also, there was actually a crematorium there. It wasn't the same way they had it in death camp. But when you see the little children, you see all the artwork they did there. Is that in the ghetto? You see all the art and all the life they had and all destroyed. It's much more powerful. It's very, obviously it's hard for me. Thank God I came from a family where most of the family was here well before the war. My grandparents were here before the war. I don't have that experience that some of my friends did, my classmates, whose parents were survivors, are survivors. So it's hard, but it shows how easy it is for memory to fade. But, you know, the impact of the Holocaust, when you think what could have been the results, what would be, it's more than, you know, tragic out of us, that we all know. Okay, Elie Sion, the last of the keynote, which is in a sense, page 61 at the bottom, we'll sing our traditional tune. This becomes a tune. It's interesting, in Europe, in many of the shuls, they actually use these tunes all 3 weeks. We have them in, and we only use it on the Shabbos before the Shabbat. But it talks about, like a woman in labor cries out the pain, so too the pain of the Jewish people. And Eli Sion is really discusses what we've lost. Eli Arman Hashem Mitash, the beautiful palace, Bash Motsana Dareha, it's the enemy has come in. Those who make fun of God have come in. The Toch Midash, we can enter the inner sanctum of the temple. Alei Galot Mashar Kael, my name is Yir Mareha. Those who sang the songs are exiled.
it talks about the loss of our Sanhedrin. In the next paragraph, in Tul Sanhedrin, he's facing me down. We no longer have the Pinjon of the Bechor, the Korbanot, all the Kelim, all the 92 vessels, I believe, that they used in the Beit HaMikdash, are Kavod, Alei Kavod, Asher Kalah, the honor, as I mentioned earlier, the honor of the Jewish people, not the temple itself, the honor of the Jewish people is being destroyed when the temple was destroyed. So we go through and we cry out, and there's really, we end this intent on a sad note. The Kina does not end like the Haftorah ends on a sort of a positive note, like some of the Kinot ended on a positive note. Here it sort of ends, we end the Kina with the lament. We're sort of in our sackcloth, just like a woman, like finds out, although the image of the woman in labor pains is a comforting image, because even though the woman's in pain now, the fact that she'll have a child, they're looking forward to giving the birth of the child. So in a sense, the entire Kina is comforting to the Jewish people. These are great pains, but out of the great pains, instead, should come something, you know, good. If we learn the lesson, as the keynote said, we, unfortunately, we don't want the suffering, and thank God for most Jews around the world, life is quite good as we began, and it should continue and get even better, but the suffering, the historical suffering of the Jewish people, the least we can do is to learn from it and become better people because of it, so at least it can be a partial comfort. So let's say it all together.
Thank you. Yashtay Mekash. Adashay Yashtay Mekash.